Many thanks. I will speak in English, unfortunately, for the German speaker. I'd like to first have the thought for someone, the name is not well known yet, David Buckle, who committed suicide by burning himself in Brooklyn a few days ago, out of despair for the way in which we became unsensitive, so to speak, to the what I call the new climatic regime. And he burned himself with oil against the oil interest, so to speak. Those of my generation remember Jan Palach, sacrifice, and in 1969 in Prague, who also burned himself out of despair about the complete indifference at the time on against the Soviet invasion of Czechoslovakia. And I'm very moved by these two characters. Only one of them is now an icon in the history of the 20th century, because they are two gestures by absolutely honest person who saw no way to articulate their political position, and out of despair in the way we, so to speak, I mean, 1968 generation and now your generation, could not support, so to speak, or articulate in any thoughtful way in which how can we do politics with the new political question. And of course, Palach was working and using a repertoire of politics we are familiar with, we were familiar in the 20th century. And the problem with David Buckle is that we don't even know how to understand this sacrifice, because we have no political register to talk about the fight in which we are engaged. But I think this character should be celebrated at the beginning of this. I'm going to make three points. One of them is to summarize, as far as I can, this little book, which Zurkamp kindly published in German, this definition of the terrestrial as a possible name for new horizons of politics. Then I will discuss one paper by Professor Schellenberger on the Copernican Revolution, and we'll discuss, and I'm very glad to have this occasion to discuss with him, if it's a counter-Copernican Revolution or Copernican Revolution, and evaluate, so to speak, the solidity of the notion of Gaia. And then I will raise again the question which John mentioned in his 1999 paper, which is, what progress did we make in the invention of a political subject who can articulate, who is able to articulate the new political position? And I'll end up very briefly on a sort of political philosophy point. The general point which I will make in all these lectures is that one of the causes, there are many others, but one of the causes of our inability to articulate a position has a philosophical root. We are unable to understand what we are made of, so to speak, which is one of the limits of our political position. This is what I will try to do. Okay, the first point is a summary, or at least one of the arguments made in this terrestrial manifest. In France, it had a less grandiose title. It was just Where to Land, but our friend from Zurkamp made it sound more grandiose than I wanted it to be. So let's be it. It's a terrestrial manifest. The point I make in the book is that there is a link between the conservative revolution, which is now happening everywhere in the planet, and the denial of climate transformation. So this is obvious in a way, and then not articulated in another way. What is obvious is that when you are faced every day with the news about the transformation of a planet, what do you do with all this news about the ice, about the disappearance of the insect, about the CO2, about the ice sheet, about soil disappearance, etc.? And even if you are not interested in that, you keep getting this news constantly, and it just eats you up in some sort of sense. And one of the symptoms of this transformation has been the conservative revolution, which is often understood as a return, or as, to use another book by Zurkamp, great regression, as if we were again witnessing something like in the 1930s. And I think that would be a mistake. It's a very new conservative revolution, so to speak, which is registering in the worst possible way, but still registering a transformation of the Earth system. And that's the point I want to make, because in a way it was made for me by the man whose name I don't want to pronounce, but you know him, who on the 1st of June 2017 withdrew from the Paris Agreement. And of course, it's an important diplomatic gesture, but I take it as a very important philosophical gesture, which is the first time a country, one of a country which was part of the West, says the way in which nature functions in our land is not the way you have nature in your land, so to speak. So a sort of a breach, not only of political interest, but a breach of the way the link between politics and nature was organized before. We know that people have different views about society and politics. This is not surprising. But for the first time, someone explicitly said, in our government, in the United States of America, there is no climatic transformation whatsoever. And you, the rest of the world, can get lost, so to speak. And that creates, for me, a transformation. At least this is the argument in the small book. It makes a very big shift in the way we understand where the sort of world community or modern view of the world was leading to. This diagram is just a simplification, but basically we agreed that there was a great interest in moving from the local to the global, from the small sort of traditional or more archaic past towards something which would look like the horizon of the globe, so to speak. A global view was supposed to be better. And the movement forward, what I call the modernizing front, modernizing frontier, was organizing the way we describe regression and progression, the way we describe left and right, progressive and reactionary, and even the difference between the past and the future. So we had this organization, and it sort of was a vector that made easy to differentiate politically where people were standing. Now, the difficulty is that the notion of globalization has itself suffered a complete transformation. So now there is completely two different meanings of the word. Global and globalization were associated for many years, many decades, with a multiplication and amplification of the numbers of way of being associated and to be understanding how the world works. So the more globalized you were, the more, in French we use mondialisation as well as globalization, the more diversity of views, cultural aspect, and attention and attachment you had. But now, since the last 30 years, and in my view, largely because what happened to the planetary system, what we mean by globalization is exact reverse. We mean by globalization a provincial extension of a very, very, very tiny numbers of standard about how to live, what it is to be a subject, what's to be to have a law, what it is to calculate your interest, and so on and so forth, which have been spreading all over the planet and eating up at the diversity and multiplicity of life forms. And when I say life forms, I'm not talking only about humans, I'm only also talking about all of the animates with which we collaborate, so to speak. So when you say, I'm against globalization, we never know which one is it. Is it the one which increased the numbers of diversity, the amount of diversity, or is it the one that actually decreased it? And that creates, in my view, a sort of disorientation. And it is this disorientation that explains the conservative revolution. People have heard through the press, in the scientific dispatches, through, of course, the extraordinary increase in inequalities in economic revenues and so on. They have understood that what we meant by the horizon of modernization, the globe of globalization, the attractor to which they were ready to do sacrifice, is actually gone. You can read paper, and when you read, even if you don't read it seriously, but you see in The Guardian a piece about we have only 50 years of soil left, even if you are not interested in ecology, it eats at you. And the solution is, of course, the one which we are very well aware of, which is to say, okay, let's go back to the local. So the conservative revolution is this sensation, this feeling that if the globe is actually gone, if the horizon of globalization is inaccessible, at least let us go back to what we know as protection, identity, borders, walls, and so on. And I don't need to stress that in Germany, but it's true everywhere, not only in Europe, but of course in England with the Brexit, as well as in America with the man whose name should not be pronounced, but needs a wall. So the disorientation, my argument is that the disorientation is due to the feeling that there is something wrong in the definition of a very horizon toward which politics was actually aiming at. It's not a shift on values. It's not a shift in sort of political attitude only. It's a shift in the definition of the shape of the world on which politics is supposed to apply itself, so to speak. So we have a third attractor. I don't think I have a pointer there, so you see it here, which is strangely drawn there, the new sort of attractor which weighs on the definition of those who wanted to go to the global and those who wanted to go back to the old local, which I have no name for it. I don't want to call it the Earth too fast. I don't want to call it nature too fast, for a reason which I'll say in a minute. And I call it the terrestrial. The terrestrial is a sort of new entity which he's claiming to have attention. And we don't know how to do it because we are still in the old modernizing vector, so to speak, on the attractor one going to attractor two or backward. And the difficulty of every politics of a climate, so to speak, every questions around how come that we don't have the articulated, efficient politics to deal with the problem is because we don't know how to orient ourselves to this third attractor, which I call the terrestrial. And it's a difficult one because it requires alliances, which are difficult to do. It's not a return to the past local, even though it has lots of connection with it. In France, we just had a big event around the ZAD of Notre-Dame-des-Landes, which was the project of an airport which was finally abandoned. And the ZAD for us is a very important signal of a change. Is it the ZAD local because it sort of argued against an airport? No, because it's also a very worldly, mondial ways of organizing politics and agriculture and imagining alternative ways of doing it. So it doesn't fit into the reactionary progressive definition. Abandoning an airport, it's reactionary. No, because it's not return to the past, it's doing something else. So every single question in political ecology turns around this question of not fitting into the traditional one, two vectors, but in modifying how we define the new horizons of politics. And the difficulty is how to understand this terrestrial. So the two other parts of my talk are devoted to this. This is, there was a very interesting show in Paris by an historian of architect, a historian of architecture around the difficulty of making spheres and globes in architecture. There's a whole history of that since the Roman time. And this is the cover of a book that we choose with Zurkamp. So the globe is always, we have always the illusion that if we were thinking globally, ecologically, we would put things in a globe. But of course, what happened is that it's not the globe. What we are putting things in is actually something else, which is a flat dimension in which we have to land. So what I want to sort of visualize to you in the second part is the difference between the sphere, the globe, and the terrestrial, so to speak. Now, what is, and I, of course, studied that quite at length in another book, which has another grandiose title, Kampf Gaia, but when you are translated in German, it always sort of amplify your seriousness, which is a paper by John Schellenhuber, which is a very interesting paper which I reread recently for this lecture. It's just almost just 20 years ago. It's about the counter-Copernican revolution. Sorry, it's about the second Copernican revolution. And it argues about transformation as important now with what is he calls Earth system science as the first Copernican revolution, which was associated with Galileo and Kepler and the others. But what I want to understand is what exactly means is this Copernican revolution. If we take seriously the metaphor that John used in his paper, and I think there is a difference between the Earth and the globe. The terrestrial is not exactly the globe. And that's it's a prime of visualizing the terrain on which politics is exerting itself. I know that the great idea about a global view, of ecological view, and even Earth system science is to reuse the metaphor and the visual of the Earth seen from the space station and hear about the Apollo thing. And there was actually in this very building a few years ago a very beautiful exhibition on the history of the old Earth catalog and of the image of the blue planet. But what happened is exactly the opposite, actually. Far from uniting, the global view is actually, now we know, a source of constant divide and polemics and controversy and even, as we know, wars. So the planetary view is not what, by sort of extraordinary influence of the beauty of a blue planet, will say, well, we are all on the same planet, thus we agree. Nature does not unite. Nature divides, and every day, and not even if we think about America withdrawing from the agreement of Paris, but every single detail about everything from the coal in Germany to the fish to the food to everything is actually a topic of political controversy. So the blue planet is not the unifying element. The blue planet is actually the source of most division. And this is why I want to shift the attention out of the notion of globe to the notion of surfaces. We are actually talking, and Bernard mentioned it in his introduction, about critical zone, about something which is a film, a surface, something which is, comparing to the notion of a terrestrial globe, almost invisibly small. And it's very strange, if you think of it, is that when we imagine the globe, if we take the globe seriously, almost everything we are aware of, everything we care for, disappears from view because it's so small. So there is actually, in the notion of globe, a very perverted way of understanding our own human and life position. And there are two reasons for that, which is summarized in this small diagram. One of them is that the critical zone, that is the thin surface on which everything of interest for the question of new climatic regime is taking place, is small. but it's also epistemologically disputed. None of the people I've met in the study of climate science and a critical zone, who are in geology, who are in agriculture, in soil sciences, in hydrology, etc., whatever paper they produce in good scientific journal, it will be disputed by other interests. I mean, there is something which is structural in the way those sciences are developing on the critical zone, which are not the case if you study the rest of the universe or if you study the deep Earth plate tectonics or the center of the geophysics of the Earth. Whatever you say, for example, I just learned that if you write a paper about the part per million of CO2 is now 410. If you write a paper on that in the best scientific journal, you will be immediately accused by some other interest of wanting to destroy the state of the economy of the United States. So if every state of fact being published in this domain, which is the critical zone science, will be in the middle of a controversy. And there is no better example than the book by Michael Mann. I don't know if you can read it, but the subtitle is Dispatches from the Front Lines. He's the man who, you know, the one who was engaged into the dispute about the hockey curve. And it's a typical case. It is actually a war with a front line. And it is impossible to make this discussion more sort of safe and say, well, I'm just doing science and I'm not doing politics. It's impossible there. So the question of studying the thin surface is actually epistemologically fraught with difficulty and polemics, and also it's not concerned with the rest of the, not necessarily concerned with the rest of the universe. And that's why I would prefer counter-Copernican revolution. It's back to a highly specific question raised about the Earth, the thin biofilm of the Earth, which have to be engaged in a relation between scientists and politics and citizen, which is unusual for the rest of the science of the universe. And for me, this is what I learned largely from the, I would call it Lovelockian Margulis Gaia hypothesis. I know it's always difficult to talk about Gaia among anywhere, because people associate Gaia with a sort of lots of strange things. But for me, Gaia is actually something, and we'll discuss, of course, with John in a minute, which is the association of two different points, one by Lynn Margulis and the other by James Lovelock, who took the question I'm raising of what is the Earth made of, the critical zone made of, from two completely different views, Lovelock taking it from the top and Margulis from the elements. But what you have to understand is that Gaia has nothing to do with the Earth being alive or balance of nature, all of these things. I mean, it's actually a recomposition of what the agent of the world, the small world, the thin, biofin world, are made of. And my argument is that our political impotence is largely due to the philosophical difficulty we have in understanding what sort of agent we are. You cannot ask for a political agent to take seriously the climate transformation without asking the question of who are the agent, what it is to have agency. And what is really interesting in these two characters is that they blurred the distinction between biotic and abiotic element at two different levels. This is pictures of Lovelock, which I took. Probably it will be slightly irritating for John, because it's the example of Lovelock a bit as a maverick, making fun of the other scientist. He's in his own laboratory. He has everything in his own little cell, and he's obviously a contrarian scientist. But what interested me is that he modifies, and this is a famous piece of evidence which is now almost 75 years old, but which is still very important to understand. A very simple piece of evidence, but very dramatic, and which, in my view, is entirely justify the argument about the Copernican revolution, which is, if you look on the left side, the Earth side, balance of chemical in the atmosphere, there is none of this is possible on the, if the planet had no life that you have on the right side. It's a very simple, it's a, one of the original paper from Lovelock in 65, which is a very simple argument, is that nothing what happens in this room in terms of the chemical atmosphere is understandable without life having produced it. So the life is not in an environment. Life is producing its own environment, and life is what has actually made this environment possible. Now, this argument, in a way, was known. It was known from Vernadsky. It has been going on for a long time. What is really interesting is in the connection with Margulis' argument. And by the way, there is a new film, which this is a bit of a publicity for the film about Margulis. And Margulis was also a maverick scientist in biology, and now she has moved much more to the center with this discovery, and this word is now very famous, the word of holobions. We are all holobions. I mean, now no one will say, I'm a body, I have a body. You'll say, I have my body, so many cells, plus all of my microbes, and we evolved together happily. Which is very funny, actually. We now are very pleased to be multitude. We are multitude. Not in the Deleuzian sense. No, we are multitude in terms of microbes. I mean, it's me and microbes who evolve, which is one of the things. And so there's two, what is absolutely crucial about Gaia is to understand that these two revolution, in conceptual revolution, are, of course, the same one. There's no distinction between biotic and abiotic things on Earth. And the unit itself is not a unit of a self. The unit is actually an holobiome, that is an assembly of elements which have taken and kidnapped one another and are entrelacés, as is a topic of the title of a new French book, overlapping, linked together in strange ways, folded into one another. And this is summarized beautifully in a paper by Scott Gilbert. I like the title because it takes up from one of my titles. We have never been individual. So you have never been individual. It's not just we, right? It's you. We report here that the zoological science are also finding that animals are composite of many species living, developing, and evolving together. The discovery of symbiosis throughout the animal kingdom is fundamentally transforming the classical conception of an insular individuality into one into which interactive relationship among species blurs the boundaries of the organism and obscures the notion of essential identity. This is the point I want to make. If we want to have a political philosophy adjusted to the climate transformation, it's of course the definition of a subject of what it is to have agency, which is, has to be modified. And it's precisely this double modification which is, for me, in the connection between Margulis and Lovelock. It's very funny because I don't know if it's a German new trend, but you seem to be producing lots of those books now about trees having all sorts of communication, microbes in my intestine being very interesting and having lots of things to say about yourself. Julia Anders, I think she sold 1 million copies book, right? I mean, it's an amazing success. Well, we now have a French book at Tous Entrelacés. I mean, there are hundreds of these books which are modifying the way we define the self. And I think this is a very important aspect of the political transformation of the, I don't know about the German part of the guts and trees, but. So the end of this second part is with this very important paper by Tim Lenton. Tim Lenton was one of the best students of Lovelock, in a way, indirectly, which is, it might be slightly difficult to interpret, but it just to summarize the two points about Margulis and Lovelock. Life forms have extended in space, this is the vertical, and in time, this is the horizontal. And at each of these successes, so to speak, there is a different mechanism allowing for the feedback of these life forms. And of course, you cannot expect the feedback mechanism, the coupling in cybernetic term, to be the same and to be as accurate for things like, I don't know, the control of the internal temperature of the body and for the climate, which is a very weak coupling, and also, as climate scientists sadly knows, a very fragile one. So what these pictures summarize is the possibilities that when we talk about the Gaia hypothesis or Earth system science, we are talking about level of control and level of processes of the life forms which have made their own environment completely different. There is no unity of Gaia. And that's the great advantage compared to the notion of nature. Nature implied a unity of the mechanism at work. And it was very difficult after that to make the link with society, diversity of cultures, and so on and so forth. Which now we are looking for something which is precisely extend to the former nature and to the former cultures, the same sort of repertoire. And that's essential for political philosophies. And that would be the third point, the emergence of a new political subject. In his original paper in 1999, actually, John Manchin is a mathematician and a formalist, so the subject of political philosophy, the one we study at great pain in reading, I don't know, Aristoteles or Rousseau, is replaced by an S, with a capital S, in the equation. Here, and I want to interview John in a minute to understand what he meant by this S and how he follows it. S is supposed to be a subject able to take over the reflexive dimension that the word Anthropocene is summarizing. Is there a subject able to be the subject of a climate transformation we are now doing to the Earth, and the Earth is reacting back to our action? There is a cycle, but there is no subject. And of course, this question was raised, and I was absolutely astonished to see that in his paper, he actually mentioned Hobbes and the Leviathan, which I use as a very important part of the book on Gaia, which is twice the same question, one in the 17th century, what it is to have a subject, what it is to have a political entity, the Leviathan, what it is to have order in the society and in nature. And now we are raised exactly to, sorry, we are asked to raise exactly the same political question. Not only political science, but also natural science. What are the subject? What is nature? What sort of entity we are supposed to have as a subject? But if you see, this is the paper in Nature, which was summarizing the Anthropocene discussion a few years back. And this is the image. And you see the guy is completely blind. So this is John Schellenhuber. Subject? it's a blind monster like the Leviathan, which has absolutely no idea what happened to it, but which is running to the catastrophe blindfolded, just knowing what to do with it. Okay, so that's where we are. Inventing a subject and inventing in a multiplicity of disciplines exactly the same problem as the one which was taken by Hobbes in the 17th century. With the strange problem of a return of the question of anthropomorphism, which is a very strange question coming back. Is the subject of a new politics of climate similar, resembling the subject of politics in the Hobbesian sense in the 17th century? Can we recognize it as a subject? There's a very strange quote by Lovelock. I mean, people who like Lovelock never like his political position, usually. And I'm the same as everybody else. But this one is really interesting. The Gaia hypothesis implies that the stable state of our planet, which we'd call sustainability in a way, include man as part or partner in a very democratic entity. What could it mean to say that the entities which compose the critical zone of the terrestrial are democratic? Well, there is one sense only in which it has a meaning, and it's not to be found in political philosophies. I think really right now, and this is, I'm glad to say that in this place here in Haus der Kultur in der Welt, because I think it's one of the important agenda of the place, what they did with the Anthropocene, is that it's to be found in the arts. And today, I've just finished the book last week, the most advanced re-understanding of what is the subject in the new climatic regime is this book by Richard Powers, The Other Story, which is about trees and people fighting and militant burning themselves, actually. This is why I make the link at the origin with David Buckle, and burn and attacked for their defense of trees. And of course, it's a magnificent novel, but it's also a very important exploration of a new connection between trees and people, which does not anthropomorphize the trees in any sort of sense, but builds the new relation between trees and people, which give them the political maturity, the political articulation, which I'm looking for in this inquiry, which is, you could say, well, what is missing is a subject of authority. And many people who have worked in ecology are sort of appealing to, let's have a dictator of representing the planet of something. I mean, let's have something which is as strong as a strong power as possible. But we know now where the people go who aspire to a strong power. They go to the conservative revolution path and back to the nation state. So it's very difficult to imagine a dictator of a universal interest. So the paradox is that when we need a subject to take over the role of a political character, it's the very definition of what is an anthropos which is being disputed. And this is very well articulated by Clive Hamilton in a very strange book called Defiant Earth. I don't know if it's in German, which is an argument about, look, everybody is now discussing the anthropocentrism. Everybody wants other definition of the anthropos. People are criticizing the very word Anthropocene because it brings the Anthropocene back. And I, Clive Hamilton, am just warning you, no, it's just a time when you need precisely a human form back. And this is a quote. Future of the entire planet, including many forms of life, is now contingent on the decision of a conscious force, the S of a paper by John many years ago, even if the signs of it acting in concert are only embryonic and may be still born. I think we agree on that. In the face of this brute fact, denying the uniqueness and power of human becomes perverse. So this is where we are in a quandary, which is, do we modify the definition of what it is to be a human agent just at the time when a human agent, powerful and in command, is requested? Or what do we do? And of course, the contradiction is between the work of people like Clive Hamilton and many of my friends. Clive is also a good friend of mine, by the way. Like Anna Tsing, in this beautiful book, The Mushroom at the End of the World, this amazing anthropological book by Korn about trees. Haraway, of course, Staying with the Trouble. Great. Three of them are great critique of the word Anthropocene, precisely because it brings the anthropos back in, and they want to redistribute the human in very original and disputed way. So this is where we are. To conclude, what was really stunning in the piece by John in 1999 was to frame the question of Earth system science as a Copernican revolution. But I think you see that I'd prefer to call it a counter-Copernican revolution. That is, not going from the Earth in the center to the Sun at the center, but on the contrary, back to the Earth, except it's a very, very different Earth. It's just the critical zone. It's actually made of agents which have very specific properties, which are no longer objects sitting side by side, and which have, of course, the discovery, which is new, we never had to take that into account before, that their action is actually having the environment react on themselves. And this is what, in a way, the striking parallel between the two revolutions is that it's much more difficult to live in our paradigm shift, so to speak, because when we were talking about the first Copernican revolution, it was a change in our interpretation of the world, of the way the world worked, but it didn't change the world itself. It changed the way we understood it. And now what we are talking about is actually a paradigmatic transformation that if we don't do anything, the world in which we are, not the universe, the critical zone, will itself be transformed and modified. So in a way, the stakes are much higher. And I want to make some publicity for, I mean, it's a bit late for publicity because it's a film for, it's an absolutely, I mean, I'm sure in German you have many films about Galileo's, Life of Galileo by Brecht, but I recommend this one by Loze. And Loze was the one who actually represented the first instance of the life of Galileo in Los Angeles in 1945. And it's what is beautiful in the play is that there is a clear connection between if you change the order of a planet, if you go from Earth-centered to Sun-centered, you modify the whole political order. So now we understand that very well for now. And that's why so many people say there is no transformation of the climate, nothing is modifying. Because they know that if you modify anything about the order of the world, you modify the order of society completely. So there is a clear parallel between what happened at the time of Galileo and what happened now in terms of a cosmology. But of course, as is shown in many of the papers by John and others, is that the situation is much worse, so to speak, because it's not just if we interpret badly the Copernican revolution, you would have difficulty in your calculation about the planet, but the rest of the phenomena will remain exactly the same, no matter if the sun turns around or the earth turns around. And here, if we don't find the right interpretation and the right connection between the order of the world and the order of society, we change the world. The world will get into, like in those dramatic drawings, into a state of inhabitability, out of which we will might not recover. Well, I wish I would have said something more positive at the end. But it's not the sort of topic where you can end very positively. I started with the David Bucker death. And as Anat Singh said, we have to learn how to live in the ruins, which is, I think, a very important way. But I'm very happy to be here and very happy to be able to discuss with John on some of the topics I mentioned today. Thank you very much.